Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Do you eat, sleep, and breathe golf? Do you love to explore? And most importantly, do you just want to have some fun? Well, then welcome to Talking Golf Getaways with Mitch and Darren. Now here's the guy with all the questions, Mitch Lawrence, and the guy with all the answers, Darren Bunch.
Hello and welcome once again to Talking Golf Getaways with Mitch and Darren. I'm Mitch Lawrence in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Darren Bunch out there in the wilds of California on the western edge. Darren, I know you and I are both excited to share our discussion with our great guest today, all the way from Canada, someone you got to spend some time with. Ian Andrew will be joining us in just a couple of minutes.
Oh, yeah. My new friend, Ian Andrew. We spent some time in Northern Ireland together. And at the time, like most things, I'm a little slow. It took me a while to realize that he was the one who did the restoration work at our favorite Highlands Links on Cape Breton Island. So we're going to talk about Highlands Links. We're going to talk about Stanley Thompson. We're going to talk about all kinds of good stuff today.
But first, excitement reigns here on the Talking Golf Getaways podcast, not only because it's a new year for golf and travel, which we obviously love, but because we want to welcome a fantastic new partner to our Golf NewsNet team. Two Under is an incredible company that makes, among a wide variety of products, high-performance men's athletic underwear. And Darren, we're going to be talking about Two Under often. There are so many great qualities to the various styles in the Two Under line. But one thing I know is this is not your grandfather's underwear. Everything else has evolved in terms of technology, and Two Under was literally the innovator, the leader in creating something under your pants, your shorts, and in our case, of course, under our plus fours, that truly makes a difference in the comfort and the enjoyment we feel while playing golf.
And Two Under underwear, and try to say that fast a few times, Two Under's proprietary Joey Pouch technology, hashtag asset management. It's uniquely comfortable. It's supportive environment for our most valuable assets, plus great fabrics designed to provide maximum comfort and confidence. Come in a huge variety of designs and colors.
And I have to say, Darren, and I know, let's say off the bat that this is a subject that you and I and probably most guys never really talked about, never thought about it, was underwear. But this is so different. And I can say from experience that the Joey Pouch changed my life. That's all I'm going to say. The Two Under underwear fits great. The fibers are great. There's a non-roll waistband that is absolutely fantastic. And without going into too much detail, they're no drip tip. Use your imagination. I am telling you, life-changing. And it's why golfers like William McGirt, David Toms, Jerry Kelly, and more wear Two Under. And how about this? Mike Dobbin, the Remax long drive tour player, whose longest drive is 551 yards. You think he could have done that without Two Under? I don't. They have an incredible lineup of athletes in other and often much more demanding sports as well. You can find out everything you want to know about Two Under at their website, Two Under, and that's the number two, and then the letters UNDR, twounder.com, on all the social media sites, at Two Under on Twitter and Instagram, and Two Under on Facebook.
And here's our way of letting you experience what Two Under is all about. If you go to the Two Under website at twounder.com and use the promo code GNN20. That's for Golf NewsNet, GNN20. You get 20% off the normal retail price. Again, that's promo code GNN20 equals 20% off. It's a great deal for what could easily become your personal emergency nine favorite piece of golf apparel you can't live without. So get your Two Under today.
We're glad you found us at golfnewsnet.com, on iTunes Podcasts, Audio Boom, Stitcher. Darren, you can find, of course, on social media at Getaways Golf on Twitter, at Golf Getaways on Instagram. You can find me on both at Mitch Lawrence, it's L-A-U-R-A-N-C-E. And let us dive right into it, because Darren and I, if you listen to the podcast, you know that we are big fans of classic golf course design, that we are hickory players, that we are tied to the history of the greatest game. And there are very few people, I would dare say anywhere, who are tied the way Ian Andrew is to the classics of the game. Wonderful, thoughtful restorations, renovations, as well as new design work on courses throughout Canada and the United States, mostly in the Northeast. The sole proprietor of Ian Andrew Golf Design, and some of the iconic, listen to this list, some of the iconic architecture names that have been entrusted to Ian's care, and it is that. It is entrusting those great courses to Ian's care. Stanley Thompson, Donald Ross, A.W. Tillinghast, Harry Colt, Walter Travis, Seth Rayner, Willie Park. The list goes on and on, and he has been praised not only by golfers who benefited from his passionate pursuit of giving us all the most worthwhile and beautiful connections to the game, but by fellow architects, and I loved reading their remarks. It's a true measure of the respect and the esteem in which he's held. You can find a wealth of information on Ian at his great website, andrewgolf.com, on Twitter and Instagram, at IanAndrewGolf. And as Darren said, he was lucky enough to spend some time with Ian on a trip to Northern Ireland, and I am absolutely thrilled, after Darren and I just got finished up at Highlands Links on Cape Breton Island, to be able to talk to him about that course and so much more. And great to have some time with you, Ian. We really appreciate you coming to us all the way from Canada. Welcome to Talking Golf Getaways.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to this very much.
Well, you say that even after spending some time with Darren in Northern Ireland?
I say that especially after spending time with Darren. I couldn't have had more fun. We even managed to play a magical 36 at Royal County Down together. And I had a great deal of respect for the fact that he was playing hickories and played well with them. But also, it was just the conversations about golf as well. Golf is such a social game on top of being a sport. And I think the conversations on the course and then off the course were as much fun as the golf.
Well, that's why we play. That is exactly what you said, and why we play. Let's start off, if we can. There's so many areas we could delve into, but I think Darren may know this already, but I and the listeners will be interested. Your love of golf architecture and the history of architecture, and if you want to kind of blend that into Stanley Thompson in particular, but where did that all begin? At what point did you say, not only do I love the game, but this is what fascinates me and the area that I want to get into?
Well, I fell in love with the game watching golf with my father, and for me it was Pebble Beach. Pebble Beach sort of hooked me into the spectacular place that it was, and then the more I wanted to learn about it, and I'm talking about preteen too, which is really bizarre, I know. But I used to sketch holes and just spend a lot of time trying to discover a lot about that golf course. So it was sort of my first love was actually Pebble Beach. And I asked my father if somebody actually designs golf courses. I was kind of perplexed how did these things happen? And then he mentioned that they did and encouraged me. And he bought me a series of books. One was the World Atlas of Golf, and then another one was the Golf Course Construction book by George Thomas, which in hindsight I realize is a very valuable book, but he managed to find me a copy. And sort of by the age of 13, I was absolutely hooked on not only golf architecture and wanting to be a golf architect, but if you think about the courses I was looking at, they weren't modern golf courses. They were all golden age era golf courses that essentially I'd, through the books that I had that he had provided for me, I'd focused in on these. And then my dad set out I was about the age of 16. We set out to, I guess it was make five major trips. So he introduced me to Scotland and England, Monterey Peninsula, Pinehurst. Pinehurst was probably the most important architectural moment for me. And there's a funny story to that. And then we also went down to the Westchester area. So it was just he wanted me to understand, if I really wanted to get involved with golf, he wanted me to understand what great golf was. And that really took me into that golden age era. And that's essentially what I spend all my time doing, is restoring golf courses from essentially 1890s through to about 1935 would be about the limit. I try to avoid anything after that if I can.
Well, what a great, great, first of all, what an unbelievable thing for your father to be able to do and to give you that chance. But you can't just say there's a funny Pinehurst story.
That's exactly what I was going to say too.
Everything I learned about architecture came from one round of golf. It sort of set the wheels in motion. So I was 16. I would say it's probably the best golf I ever played in my life was through that period. I actually was a decent player through that period. And my father was always a great player, more body breakdown than anything else, but one of the best short games and clutch putters I've ever known. But my dad could flat out play at times. And we were down at Pinehurst, and I had hit the ball tremendously well, but I seemed to have this knack of lots of pars and an occasional birdie. I really was playing well that day, but I kept making doubles. I'll give you an example. If you know the course well, I hit it over the back of 8, so you can imagine what that number was. Again, chasing a pin, too cocky, too full of confidence. And I was playing, and I always played my father, and to sort of come to the end of many stories, I never actually beat my father head-to-head. I never could do it. He's too good a player. But my dad had hit short of the green on almost every green. And we got to the end, and I made the comment to my dad that I didn't break 80, which I should have, because I was playing really well. And I said, you know, I hit the ball well, but I didn't score as well as I should have for how well I hit the ball. And I said, you hit it like crap all day long, and you've got this ridiculously good number, which was 74 or 75, whichever it was. And I said, you beat me easily, but you played like crap, and you just got away with it. And my dad said, do you not understand this game? Do you not understand that golf course? And he spelled out to me that essentially, after looking at the greens, he had figured out a number of times he just didn't have the game to play to those spots, and the risk was too high. But what he figured out was where he could play to, knowing that he would probably get up and down most of the time. He was a tremendous, tremendous bump and run player, like unbelievably good, and 50, 60 yards out even was deadly, was capable of hitting it to, inside the collar or inside the leather, a lot of gimmies. And Dad just put on a clinic of getting up and down all day and had this wonderful round with no blemishes. And he explained to me afterwards that he had played perfectly, but he'd also taken exactly what the golf course had given and then not asked for anything more. And that's why he had a good score. And that essentially I got sucked in and then kind of walked me through each of the holes. But the interesting thing for me was after I got over my own disappointment in losing to my dad and essentially probably throwing away a round that really could have been, I started to realize what the architecture was there, what it asked me to do, what it asked me not to do. And the whole premise of allowing you playability, because you can't lose a golf ball out there. And it's really hard to shoot your handicap. And the reason being is as soon as you get aggressive, as soon as you try to score, as soon as you push, it's the misses is where it punishes you. And it punishes you incredibly tough in some instances. And showed me a style of architecture that I've tried to emulate later in life. The clever thing about Pinehurst number two is rather than telling you what you can't do, what the golf course does is it allows you to play any type of shot. It allows you to attack it. It allows you to play any way you want to play. But the beauty of it is if you overplay your hand, you start to get punished. And it's a golf course that's about misses. Can't lose a golf ball. All the opportunities are out there, but as soon as you get a little too cocky, it takes it out of you. And it's a golf course that the better you are, the harder you try to score, the harder the golf course becomes. And it's something that I've emulated in all my work ever since. I think stylistically, it's brilliant. As I said, you can't lose the golf ball out there, which is fun, and you can't shoot your handicap, which shows it can have teeth and still be fun. It is probably the perfect public facility.
Wow, that's actually a great way to think about it. We were just out there earlier this year, and I played number two again, and Boy, now I want to go back and play it a third time just to think about that while I'm in the middle of the round, and maybe I'd shoot a better score as well.
If you think about trying to come up just short where you've got space, because there are a couple of balls you have to fly in, but if you think about coming up just short all day long, I think you might be surprised what you shoot.
That's such a great point. I live close to Pinehurst. I talk to people all the time who go to play that golf course. And obviously the green complexes are pretty much everything there. And so many people talk about the difficulty of those green complexes, and you realize exactly what they're saying, what you've said, which is that most people don't have the game to attack. And rather than playing them in a kind of conservative way to give themselves a good chance, everybody's trying to do something they shouldn't be doing on that course.
Well, as my father would say, take what's given. Don't try to take what's not available. That was always his view. That's why he was a good tournament player. My father won a professional tournament as an amateur because it was a horrible day. And he took what was available. And the thing was, that was good enough to win that day.
Well, let's take this kind of mentality then in your philosophy and talk specifically about Highlands Links. We're curious about some of the challenges you had of restoring the course back to Stanley Thompson's vision. And then, you know, the amount of research. I know from traveling with you a little bit that you are no stranger to research, and you love to dive into the history of these golf courses. So, you know, talk some too about the amount of research that just went into the work you did at Highlands Links.
Well, there was some available, and Joe Robinson, who was the pro there at the time, had a booklet. And so there was a series of construction photos and early photos that were there. So there was sort of the base material. Getting aerials is pretty easy in Canada, so you could get aerials. And the interesting thing is, you can get an aerial actually that that comes before the golf course was built, which I'll try to remember to get to, because we actually used that in our restoration to make our case for historic landscape. Then I started looking around for photos, and I was able to find some through Nova Scotia archives, and I had a winter to work on the master plan, which gave me the ability to dig some more. And I started looking under Cape Breton Highlands, which is the original name of the golf course, but I started looking under more obscure names. And I started to find more and more photos. And I would say I found probably about 175 photos of the golf course by the time I was done. And one of the interesting things was I had a preconceived idea of what the golf course was like with using the photos I had, but some of the holes I had late 40s, early 50s photos. And when I found a couple of earlier ones, a good example was the Dragon and Fireball on the right of the fifth green. I didn't know that was there initially with the first research. It was actually the bigger dig that found a really great image of that, to realize that not only did he created Mucklemouth Meg, the egg-shaped green with the lady's face done by the reverse impression of the bunkers. So when you look from the air, you actually see the lady's face, and the right side bunkers are hair. But he'd also done the Dragon and Fireball on 5. I did know he'd done the landowner's face on 13. But it was interesting that the Dragon and Fireball was one of the greatest finds. But when I finally had got images together, I finally had images of everything. So I had everything covered. And the interesting thing, I was also able to prove that you could actually see the ocean from 14 holes, not from 7 or 8, because I had enough photos that I could show Parks Canada at that time that this is actually what you could see. I will go to what I mentioned about the historic landscape. We had a lot of trouble getting trees out originally. And when I first started working there, they couldn't grow grass. So in 2008, there were greens that were half mud, and it was just tree growth. And they'd gone through 10 years where the park had restricted any tree removal, and I mean anything. And so we went in there that essentially this asset and this piece of history was dying. And there is in Canada, a cultural landscape has value. And what we were able to do is make a case that the golf course being in a national park, being a public golf course by a person of national historical significance, which is Stanley Thompson, had importance culturally. And then so we were able to show them what the golf course was like originally, and they agreed to clearing, and that gave us the latitude to clear. We cleared 9 acres so far, but to clear about 12 acres of trees. 12 acres is a lot of trees, but we used cultural landscape to actually help push for opening up all the views and opening up the areas around the greens to grow turf. So now the turf finally, in the last couple of years, has really turned a corner and is actually pretty good again. But when I started there, they just could not grow grass there anymore. It was too congested, too much shade, and it literally was dying at that point, which is really sad to see because I'd been out there as a kid. One of the trips I made with my father was to Highland Links, and I played it actually when I was 17 and took photos of the whole golf course. So I was even able to show those photos and say it was wide open before. I don't even recognize I didn't recognize it when I went there the first time afterwards in 2003. I was actually shocked.
How excited were you when you kind of realized that the work you'd done research-wise and the vision that you had for what it should be was about to be given a green light to go ahead by Parks and to be able to do, I think Darren and I both felt this way certainly when we played it the first time, but definitely this time, which is to give an entire country and a world of golfers back this kind of treasure. And it really is this kind of golf treasure, historic treasure, cultural treasure. That must have been just an amazing feeling to me. I can't even imagine obviously there's a lot of work that goes into it, but just the overarching feeling of what you could do.
Well, it's my labor of love. So while some of the circumstances around it are really complicated, for me, if I can just put that back, that's enough. That's my, sounds a little cheesy, but my gift to golf is to put it back. And when we started working on it, I'd said to Graham, I don't want to change anything. I actually want to, this is our one opportunity to put something completely back. The only green that's altered there is 13. That's not going to go back. But I mean, all the rest of the greens are intact. All the bunkers are back where they're supposed to be. Everything's where it's supposed to be. You can still play the original tees. The idea that that there's one Stanley Thompson course that's 100% intact, that you can, barring obviously that green, but it's missing a swale out of the middle. That people could go and play something completely original. And then my viewpoint as an architect was architects could come and study those greens, study essentially the layout, the bunkers, and everything else. So it was a bit of an important museum piece where people could learn about Stanley Thompson. So for me, it was everything I could hope for. And the fortunate part was I'd already restored St. George's. So that was a very pressure-filled moment for me that I felt the weight of the world doing that because it was the first time I ever restored one of the five great commissions of Thompson. And so by the time I went to work at Highlands, and that's probably why I got the work at Highlands, but by the time I went to work there, I was a lot more confident and comfortable and ready just to do what needed to be done, which, by the way, really helped because we had to actually do everything by hand because while we were able to do it, we had very limited funds. They had some rules about work had to be done in-house with the union crew. So I had to teach them how to build bunkers, and we basically did it by hand. It was like going back in time. We had a backhoe once a week out of the week I was there, and the rest of it we actually did with shovels and rakes. And that's how they built it originally, and it literally was like going back in time, which, by the way, there's a certain joy. There's a lot of hard work that goes with that, but there's a certain joy to actually going old school. So it had a lot of layers to me, and I knew the town depended on the golf course as a centerpiece to draw in tourism, and they were starting to lose the clientele, and so there was a responsibility. Once I really got to know people in town, I really cared about what it meant to them. And because I cared, I think the crew was excellent. They cared too, so we were all in. So it was a very fun experience, very moving experience at times for me.
Darren, I know you want to follow up with some specific course questions, but when you just said that, the thing that struck me and was the absolute connection in a perfect way to what was happening when that course was built, like you said. It was an important works project. It employed people in the town at a really tough economic time. It was done painstakingly, and the removal of rocks and all kinds of stuff. It sounds perfect to me.
The history was that essentially Stanley Thompson went in to see William Lyon Mackenzie King, who was the prime minister at the time, and went and said, there's no work out there. And you know you want recreation in the parks. Why don't I build a series? And he was out of work. That was, you know, part of it was self-motivated. And he said, why don't I, you know, build a couple of courses by hand in the national parks? You'll have your draw. We'll put people back to work. And he sold them on the idea. And King and his people came back with a budget, a very strict budget, and said essentially, the key to Highland Links, and he also did Green Gables and PEI as well at the same time, is you need to put the maximum number of people to work. And so the interesting thing was he went to Cape Breton Highlands National Park, and he had a particular area to work and discovered he could not build golf holes on part of the property. So when he looked at going further down the coast, because the golf course would have continued along from 6, he couldn't do that because he couldn't afford to move the road. They were also supposed to look at putting it on Middlehead, which is if you went hiking trails on the other side of the Celtic Lodge, that's Middlehead. He was supposed to put 9 out there and couldn't do it because there was no soil and it was all rock. And he started to walk around and he started to walk through farms and essentially determined that the only way to build a golf course was to go through the farmlands. So he had to go over where 7 is now, 7 and 8, and then down into the Clyburn farmlands along the Clyburn Brook. And so when he came back to them, what it meant was they had to expropriate 27 farms. And the decision was made that the project was deemed important and expropriation was deemed acceptable at the time, and they literally expropriated 27 farms. And what he did was he put those families to work because they couldn't pay them for the farms immediately. That would, and it turned out to take way longer than it should have. And so he put those families to work plus families in town using a key person who helped him with that. But he had, I think it was 150 people working on the project, and most of it was done by hand. So they had one steam shovel, one truck, and they were allowed to use it once a week. And that was the rules that they dealt with. And essentially it was a 2-year build for that reason. The rooting works around where there's soil on the property. It literally follows where there's material you could actually build golf holes out. And the rest of it, if you go any direction off the golf holes, you'll find it's all rock. And that's essentially the sort of the foundation of how we got to that golf course. And it's there to keep the town there. The town's still there. It did work. But there is some hard feelings from the expropriation still even to this day.
And the fact that they acquired that land is, to me, one of the many things of the personality of the golf course that I think is just, so wonderful. You know, you walk past a church and a graveyard while you're on the walk. You have the long walk along the river. You have all these things. Plus, it's a near perfect rhythm of holes, in my opinion, because you've got some short holes, you've got some long holes, you've got holes that you play up to plateau greens, you've got holes that drop down, where you see them, the green is kind of tucked down in corners or down at the end. And, there's so much I love about it. One thing I wanted to ask you, and I had mentioned this at the time, I shot a picture of it. I didn't notice it while I was playing, but on the par 3, there's an S bunker. And I realized when we were at Digby Pines as well, that he really had a great, you mentioned the greens, the bunkers that look like specific things. But he also just in these places uses these kind of serpentine bunkers that are, no wider than basically your stance. And they add such characteristics and personality to the golf course that I just love, I just love seeing them and how he used them. And so few people use them in designs anymore.
Well, the big thing out there is it's just the variety, like whether it's the variety of the holes or down to the variety of bunkers, there's, to the right of that one's a bunker with an island. You know, that one's serpentine. The next one over is fairly simple, but it's not trying to make them all complex and not making any of them hardly similar. The variety came with his creativity. He certainly had an eye for the impressive, and a lot of times when he was dealing with something that was either he had a really nice face to work with or he had space to work with, he would go with something much more impressive. And then other times he was quite comfortable, like the little directional bunker on 8 that he hit over the hill with. It's as simple as could be. It's just a little pot. There's really nothing to it. But that one is exactly the line to find the feeder slope that'll get the ball onto the grid. But it's the variety. I mean, that's as tiny as it could be. And then there's some mammoth bunkers on 15. And I just, that's the one thing that he was so good at was, it took him a while to develop him, right? Because his early work is fairly simple. But by the time he got to Jasper, he'd figured out scale. By the time he got to Banff Springs, he'd figured out scale still needs intimate details. And so he'd honed his craft. Then he learned more about three-dimensional, you know, working not only with that scale and that complexity, but depth as well at St. George's. And so he sort of progressed. And Capilano, he kind of backed off and realized bunkerless greens are good or bunkerless sides are good and kind of eased off. And then you kind of get all of that knowledge shows up at Highlands in one go. So you've got super dramatic bunker on 15 that kind of funnels you into that green. But there's no bunkers on 2, which I think what makes the second hole great is that green is so amazing, but he didn't bunker it. But you think about it, there's no bunkers on 5 of those holes. But I don't know if you noticed that or remember that, but I find most people when I say that too, they go, really? But yeah, there's 5 bunkerless holes in that golf course, which again is part of variety. It's mixing up things. It's allowing the land to speak when the land should speak, and it's using bunkers when bunkers can make sort of statements within the landscape as well, or every once in a while, like 15 green, because that's one that stands out to me. It's just, I'm going to show you what I'm capable of, and I'm in all its glory. I'm going to actually get everything to funnel in towards that back, and it funnels into that back pin position in that back bunker, and it's just really an amazing, not an illusion, but an amazing framing that whole set of bunkers makes around that really amazing green site. And part of that's to say, you know what? I know the background with Whale Island is super impressive, but I can be pretty impressive too, and I can bring your eye back to my work. I'm that good. But that's kind of the little bit of the cockiness that Thompson had. But he's right. You have to, when you're building, I think he learned that from Banff. You can't let the setting overwhelm the golf course. If you got a great setting, you do have to draw them back in. Sometimes you've got to be impressive with the architecture, draw the eye and the player back to what they're supposed to be doing, which is playing golf.
Well, it's pretty obvious if you've been listening to this discussion that we could go on for a long time. I think Darren and I agree, and we know that you feel this way, Ian, that Stanley Thompson, for most people, especially Americans, they're not really familiar with Stanley Thompson. But I have to say that the more research I did, the more time that we got to spend playing there, playing Deep Creek Pines, and certainly talking to you, all I think Darren and I hope is that this stimulates people who are golfers and who like to travel to get to places where they can play courses that were designed by really one of the most interesting, unique, larger-than-life and truly innovative geniuses when it comes to golf course design that we have in the game. So hopefully we can get you back and continue the Stanley Thompson discussion and so many other questions that we have for you, because this time has flown by. Finally, though, before we let you go, what are you working on now, currently, and maybe a couple of things besides Highlands Links that you worked on previously?
So at the moment, I'm just finishing up a restoration of Park Country Club in Buffalo. It's a Colton Allison, and bunkering work is pretty much tidied up. Just doing a lot of tree work and a lot of tee work, and then doing a little bit of tree work this fall, and then that job will be complete. So that's been pretty exciting for me. I always love to get to work with different architects and it's a Charles Allison course, so it's been a thrill. It's a really great golf course. I've got some Stanley Thompson work at Oakdale, doing another 9 of their holes, restoring bunkers. and then just lots of smaller bunker jobs, St. Catharines, which is Stanley Thompson, the Briars, which is another Stanley Thompson, just sort of starting early parts in the bunker work that's going to take place over a few years. And then just some work at Pepper Pike Club, which is a William Flynn in Cleveland, and a really amazing golf course that I don't think very many people get to see. But we're just starting into the restoration of the Flynn course there. So that's sort of my works at the moment. I'm lucky. As architects, we always consider ourselves lucky when we're busy. It's an interesting business. It's got its ups and downs.
Well, all of us are lucky that the work is there and that you're not just up to the task, but so incredibly passionate about it. Before I let you go, I have one quick question that probably most golfers. In your bio, it said mostly restoration and some renovation. I think we as just amateur golfers toss around restoration, renovation. What's the difference?
Well, restoration is when you're working with the existing architect's work, sometimes you're having to put it back together. I had to do that at Highland Links. Sometimes it's existing and you preserve it, so you may do a little bit of work, or you may, for example, with the bunker, you may strip it all out and apply different construction techniques to make sure that it's more stable, more sustainable. So that can be restoration works. For me, a lot of it's just removing trees and moving grassing lines to where they're supposed to be. So the fairway lines out to where they're supposed to be, green expansions to get greens back to where they were. And then a lot of short grass around and greens in particular. So that's restorative work. Renovation to me is when I take my ideas and I apply them to a golf course. So I've done some work around Toronto in particular where, I've been given a golf course where it doesn't have that same rich pedigree, where they would like me to do the work. And what I normally do is I will borrow from another architect and use that a bit as some inspiration, and then present some of my own ideas. So good example is Maple Downs, which is a nice rooting by William Mitchell, but the architecture was pretty limited, and they needed to rebuild all the greens, bunkers, and tees. And I used that as an opportunity actually to change the architecture, something I was encouraged to do. And then the interesting thing was we had no Rainer up here, but it was a very hilly site. And I actually borrowed a lot from Rainer because it naturally fit for me and gave them sort of a Rainer renovation to their golf course, which they've enjoyed. Funny enough, that meant pulling out half the bunkers, but a lot of grassing where feeder slopes, runoff slopes, widening out a lot of fairways to get, because it's very hilly property, to allow all that role to play. But you don't need as much bunkers if you let the land become the focus. So that's renovation. So I do a bit of both. I'm just well known for my restoration. So it's sort of the focus. It's where the work seems to find me.
Okay. Well, we're glad it does. As I
that's
said,
mine.
I can understand. I can understand why Darren spoke so highly of you and the time you guys had in Northern Ireland. And as I said, I'm sure both of us would love to have you back on at some point and continue the discussion. Darren, you want to say goodbye to your good friend Ian?
Well, we're going to have Ian on in an Emergency 9 episode, so we'll probably talk a little bit about Northern Ireland and some of the other places he's been. And, you know, it's always an ongoing conversation talking golf with Ian.
Yeah, that's true. It's a great way to put it. Thanks again, Ian. We look forward to the Emergency 9 and to having you back again with us.
I enjoyed this very much. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great. Cool. Again, you can find Ian at Ian Andrew Golf, and that's on Twitter and andrewgolf.com. And I suggest you go to the website. It's got a lot of unbelievable stuff in there. And we love talking about this. As you can tell, we're glad you're there. Couldn't do without you. Darren on Twitter at Getaways Golf, me at Mitch Lawrence, hashtag Talking Golf Getaways, hashtag Emergency 9, hashtag Two Haggis Bags. We're always happy to get back to you and share us with your friends. Rate us on iTunes. Do whatever you can. We just want to spread the word about the best in golf travel. Thanks for being with us. It's been Ian Andrews' dream to be able to bring us the great golf courses by the great masters of the world. That was his dream. We hope you run down yours. Take it away, Tom Petty. So long.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.